Welcome to the Natural Wisdom Podcast. I'm Christine Backus, your host. Today is April 23rd, 2024. We're recording this just prior to the Scorpio full moon. And I'm really excited to have as my guest today, Mario Garza. Hi, Mario. Thanks so much for joining me today.
You got it. Thanks for the invite.
Yeah, we're going to have a very fun conversation about Saturn and symbolism. But before we get there, I just want to say a couple of words about this time that we're in, because it's such a fascinating time. We've had the total solar eclipse, also known as the Great American Eclipse, on April 8th. We've had we had a full moon eclipse just prior to that. And then just this last weekend, we had two sort of heavy hitter planets, Jupiter and Uranus, come together in a conjunction in the sky. And here we are with this today's full moon sort of ending a very action-packed six-week eclipse season. And it has been feeling very up and down for me, and I know many others. In fact, in the last episode, we kind of went deeply into the astrology. But I wanted to say that today with the Scorpio full moon, it sort of feels like things are breaking loose a little bit. The eclipse kind of, or sorry, the full moon, this particular full moon officially ends eclipse season, but it's also a little bit of a purification of sorts. So we might be finding things coming up that need to be cleared. That's definitely one of the energies of this. And then the other thing I wanted to just mention about this full moon is it's in a square to Pluto, which is the planet of power and control. And so this, I'm noticing, and I don't know if anybody else is noticing, but it's kind of like another iteration of noticing where you try to stay in control rather than stepping into your power to co-create and to simply respond. And so that's, to me, that's been one of the main themes of the last year or two, is this the difference between power and control, and learning that I get to cooperate, but I don't get to impose. So that's, I just wanted to mention that. And then, Mario, I want to say a few words about who you are and why you're here, and then we're going to dive into lots of different things, I'm sure. But we might even talk a little bit more about the full moon, because I know you're already having a full moon moment. But so let me just say, so I met you, Mario. Well, I saw you first just a few weeks ago on Michelle's Healing Home podcast, where you talked about, I think the title was The Lost Lore of Saturn. And the person that had turned me on to that was Emily Trinkus, my colleague and mentor, who was with me just last week on the podcast. And she, I don't know how she found it, but she sent it to me knowing that I'm I'm sort of an incarnation of Saturn and also a Saturn lover. And the things that you said in there were so unique and had so much more depth that got me interested. And I know that you you do tarot readings, and you've been an artist and a graphic designer for, I think you've said, like 25 years, but quite some time. Mm-hmm. And then at some point you got really into this whole journey of symbolism and getting what I would call like really deeply into symbols and looking at the various layers of meaning. So I wonder if you might want to say a little bit more about yourself and what you do and what you offer. And of course, we'll put links to your website and other things in the show notes too.
Sure thing. Sure thing. Well, once again, thank you for having me. We had a great conversation. You actually booked a tarot reading a week or two ago, and I thought you were a lovely person, and we talked about a lot of interesting things. And yeah, I've been a graphic designer for 25 years. I've always been very artistic, and so I naturally have been drawn to just all things aesthetic. I've always appreciated art history and things like that. I was really lucky to come across graphic design early on in my teens. And so actually, it's really funny. The first time I heard the word graphic design, or the words graphic design, it really resonated. It was almost like a bell went off. I remember I was in junior high and someone had mentioned that their father was a graphic designer. I was like, graphic designer, why does that sound familiar? I know nothing about that, but there was something about it that really clicked with me. And then all of these years later, now I can kind of look back and see that there was some sort of, I don't know, something, resonated because of where my life had led me and how much time I've put into that craft. And so being a designer allowed me to play with imagery, play with icons, really get to know how colors work together and things of that sort, getting into typography and just, allowing me to kind of view the world in a different way, I would say. So I would look at advertisements or commercials or album covers, and I would be decoding it. I'd be dissecting it. Eventually, at some point, I went to film school, and then I realized that I really liked decoding films, student films and bigger projects and things like that. And at some point, I found the tarot, and the tarot really just opened me up to everything. So astrology, occultism, mythology, numerology, aspects of psychology, things of that sort. So really, the tarot was kind of the gateway for me to open things up in a much broader way. And prior to that, though, I was getting interested in just symbolism in general, and I didn't realize that you could buy books on symbolism. I remember the first time I came across a book on symbolism. I was like, oh, that's cool. You can actually just look into the meaning behind the lion or the bull or something like that. And so I started collecting these books over the years, and that has helped me become a better artist, a better designer. But it's also really helped with all of my work related to astrology and occultism and esoterica and things like that, because as I come across different myths or different aspects of each sign, like Saturn, I can look through a bunch of books and read the entries for the scythe. What does the scythe mean, as an example? And so it's really been this beautiful sort of trajectory where my design, artistic sensibilities merge with symbolism and all this other stuff with astrology. And at some point, I just realized that I want to talk about what I'm learning with symbolism. So I started symbolic studies. And from there, I just decided that if I'm really going to be a good symbologist, I need to have a strong foundation with astrology. And so I tend to publish content about each sign during the sign itself. So it was during Capricorn season, I believe, is when we did our last Lore of Saturn project.
I love that. And it's interesting that you came to it through the visual, excuse me, a visual media rather than, some people come to it through story and the written word. And of course, you can't really separate them, but they're different entry points.
That's right. Yes, exactly right. So my eye has been refined over the last 25 years to just see things a bit differently than other people. And so I am very visual. So a lot of my projects are visual as well. And so when I do presentations and things like that, I like to have a lot of imagery. And when I make videos too, I make really short videos about the signs. I like to just pack a lot of imagery in there as well. So yeah, absolutely. It's a different entry point for sure.
Yeah, I wonder how would you define symbolism? I think that, I'd be curious how you define it, or
Yeah,
if you.
that's a really good question. I've read a bunch of different sort of definitions over the years about it. And I think what I would say is, simply put, that everything is symbolic. Everything breaks down to being a reference to something else, essentially, right? And
Yeah.
symbols are used for communication. So around me, right? All of everything in this room has symbolic value. This candle, there's symbolic value behind the candle and the flame and the water, in this cup before me. And so really it's a medium of storage in a way because it's a reference to something else. But it's interesting that symbolism to me too, like all kind of communication, it can break down. It breaks down. There's something that can be lost in translation as well. In one way, the flame is always going to have certain attributes associated with it, but the flame fire might mean one thing to one culture and then something else to another culture, right? That's kind of what we'll be getting into with Saturn as well, and that the symbolism can kind of shift and change and be influenced by different things. And so with communication, I tend to think about how things can get lost in translation with communication. So I might say God, and you might have one perception of what God represents versus what I think in my mind, or love, or something like that, right? And so there's this interesting dynamic with each symbol in that it contains a huge well of information, a huge, huge history of information. And sometimes, you know, what's happened to me over the years is that what I first thought about a symbol shifts and changes over the years. You know, that's what happened with Saturn for me. I had one interpretation about what I really thought it was about early on. The more I did research, the more digging I did, the more I studied the symbols associated with Saturn, the more my perception changed. And I realized that, you know, the symbolic value of Saturn has changed as well. But yeah, symbolism, to me, symbols are really, they're the basic sort of essence of kind of anything and everything here in a large way, because words are symbolic. The letters that, you know, we use to write and create words are symbolic as well. Literally the syllables, you know, that are coming out of my mouth, symbolic. So whether, you know, it's a visual thing, or it's something that's you know, coming through your various senses, whether you're hearing something or you're feeling something too, there's a symbolic nature to everything. And so I tend to see it that the world of symbolism, the world of thought, the world of ideas, the world of dreams, that is to say, too, in another way, from my perception, the world of spirit preceded the physical realm, preceded the material realm. And so to me, symbolism preceded the actual objects that represent these symbols, you know. So it's like the thought form came first, the concept came first, and then the object came to be, then the material aspect of whatever it is you're talking about came to be. So I would say arguably the sort of thought form of a flame preceded an actual physical flame itself. The idea was crystallized before any such fire ever existed.
Right. Yeah, I love that. And of course there, yeah, you're not the only one that says that, right? I mean,
Correct,
that's
yeah.
how, in fact, one of my favorite examples is that this pen had to be somebody's idea, right? And it came out of a sense of desire to make a pen. Yeah.
Yes, exactly right. Yeah. So it's really interesting. I tend to think of, you know, symbols as, you know, there's an idea of like an all father or like an all mother. I think that with every single symbol. So there's the idea or concept of an all flame, an all pen, you know, or something like that. So when I see the, you know, gods and goddesses, and I read mythology, I really kind of think that what we're referring to, say, as an example, it's when we're talking about, I don't know, just as an example, Isis or something. It's like every mother is Isis, every woman is Isis, you know? And so Isis isn't some crazy foreign concept that exists really far away that you have to try really hard to interact with. You know, it's like it's the woman that you see before you. You know, it's that aspect of you as well. You have an internal aspect related to Isis or whatever it is you're talking about. So I that's how I tend to kind of perceive things. So every mother is the all mother, right? And so she is, you know, the goddess of heaven and earth. You know, she is Virgo, you know, as an example. So that's how I tend to perceive things.
Yeah, that's and I like that because that makes sense with how I see astrology too, and the planets, right? They're all archetypes within us. We all have inner Mars, our inner Venus, our inner whatever, and as you point out, there's like an Uber archetype for each one of them as well. And Saturn's a great example, right? It's one of the Well, let's get into that a little bit because it's one of the things I see as an astrologer is that Saturn seems to be maybe not always the worst, but mostly the most misaligned planet. And of course, Saturn represents the energy of contraction, but it also represents that inner authority and inner integrity. And you and I have had this conversation that that's what we are so conditioned to put outside of ourselves. But I'm curious how you came. I mean, you talked about it being a Capricorn season thing, but I think you've done so much work with Saturn. I'm sort of curious, like, What drew you, if that, if you do you think of yourself as a Saturn specialist? And if so, how'd you get there?
Right. I don't know if I would consider myself a Saturn specialist, but it's played a personal role in my relationship with my fiance. So, you mentioned that you saw us talk about Saturn on her show, Michelle's Healing Home. You're going to be on her show here pretty soon. But she's a Capricorn, and we've been together, for 11 years at this point. And she has an affinity for Saturn, always has. And I basically got into astrology while we were together. And so I always say that, you really want to be partnered with someone that you can grow with together, right? And so if there's a major conflict with how you're choosing to grow in life, depending on who you're with, a lot of people don't want to see you change. They want you to stay the same person that you've always been. And so we've always encouraged each other to grow, and look into new things and stay curious about the world around you and all of that. And so we've been able to grow together. And I would say that while I've gotten interested in astrology, Saturn spoke to me directly. And so I always had an appreciation for it, even when I didn't know the full breadth of what Saturn represented. And I would still say that I'm still learning the full breadth of what Saturn represents as well. One of the reasons why my project is called Symbolic Studies is because I really look at myself as a perpetual student, and I want to be a perpetual student. And so this avenue allows me to continue my studies, basically, and then teach people along the way what I'm learning and things like that. But as I kind of got on my journey with, the tarot and everything else, all of these nuggets about Saturn, I would always pass along to Michelle, and she was always interested because, she's a Capricorn and she really identifies with the planet too. And then we started realizing that as a couple, we're kind of a Saturnian couple. A lot of the things that we tend to talk about might be a little too dark for certain people. Our sensibilities tended to kind of go in that direction. We're okay with kind of certain thresholds of information that other people might not really want to talk about. And so we realized that we were just a different couple, probably, than a lot of other people that we would hang out with. And so I would really say that my relationship with Michelle has helped me understand a lot of aspects of Saturn, or even just having a partner who is interested in it, and encouraged my sort of research with it and everything else was a huge, huge catalyst for everything. And then as we started learning more, and as I started reading other authors about Saturn, and I started realizing that there is this primordial feminine aspect to Saturn, this golden age aspect to Saturn, she got even more excited. She's like, well, that clicks with me, that resonates, that makes a lot of sense. And so I would say that our journey together has really helped facilitate kind of what I understand about the planet now. And so to me, I kind of give her some credit with just being my partner in crime, with this whole entire journey.
Would you say that that discovery of Saturn as the ruler of the Golden Age was your biggest surprise, or was there something else that surprised you more when you learned it about Saturn?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So I come at symbolism and I kind of have a different perspective, I think, than a lot of other maybe symbologists. And so I would say the biggest surprise to me was realizing that Saturn interfaced with the other things that I realized that correspond with this golden age. And so over the last handful of years, I've gotten really interested also in the northern sky, essentially. And that's kind of where it started, but it really opened up this whole entire gateway to other information that I'm really intrigued with as well. And so I became heavily interested in the lore related to Ursa Major and Minor, the Big Dipper and Little Dipper, everything related to the North Star, the Pole Star. And what I realized in tracking this for a number of years is that it seems like there have been three major symbolic ages from what I'm gathering, that we currently live in a very solarized sort of age. So I would say that we're in the solar age right now, symbolically. This was preceded by a lunar age, which was preceded by what could be referred to as the primordial age. And sometimes it's referred to as the northern tradition or the polar tradition as well. And there's a whole big weave with all of this. It's a really, really big rabbit hole. But what I'm realizing is that this earlier age, they had a different sky clock, that their sky clock was not the path of the sun, it wasn't the ecliptic. And so all three of these ages seemingly had three different ways of really kind of prioritizing their sky clock, prioritizing how they interpret time. So today it's very much a sun-based sort of thing. In the lunar age, it was more of a lunar sort of understanding of things, right? Tracking the moon very closely. And then previous to that, it was more about the fixed stars going around the pole star, and that this was a very early primordial sky clock. And there's cultural aspects related to all of this. There's spiritual sort of implications about all of this. But I got interested in this primordial age because when you break down a lot of symbols that we have today, basically the roots of the symbolic sort of language around us comes from this early age. It's almost like talking about a tree and acknowledging the root system. You know, if you're going to walk around a forest, you're going to see the branches and the leaves, and maybe if there's fruit and flowers. But people, it's really easy to overlook the roots, right? Because they're underground, you don't see them, they're underneath your feet. But without those roots, that tree can't grow. And so this early primordial tradition is kind of like the roots for a lot of the things that we kind of see here culturally and symbolically and everything else. And so my understanding was that this earlier age, this primordial age, was also basically it basically interfaced with this previous golden age, that we're talking about the same thing, that the previous golden age interfaces and is kind of locked in with this early primordial age. And so everything had to do with a sacred center sort of concept. Everything had to do with, you know, what's at the center of everything, the center of self, the center of earth, the center of the universe, which you could see that early man, you know, if you're paying attention to the fixed stars, that all of the fixed stars go around one central star, which would be the pole star. And so they were concerned with that central portion of the heavens. Basically, that's where they were fixed. And so what surprised me the most was to find out that Saturn interfaces with all of this. And that Saturn was a key planet or the planet in this early age, which is primordial or could be considered the golden age. And when you talk about Saturn being restrictive, right, which everybody knows who tends to get into astrology, right? When you think about contraction, where are you going? You're
Right.
going to the center, right? And so to me, that was the most surprising thing to realize that this early age interfaces with Saturn. And I'll say, just very quickly, that I think you can see these three ages in the tarot. And I think you see them with the sun card, moon card, and then the star card. So the star card would be this primordial stellar age. You generally see one central star, and then there's seven stars around it. This could be the seven stars of Ursa Major. There's different opinions about what this star represents. I think it's Polaris, personally. And generally in that card, you see a woman, she's nude, she's kneeling, she's preparing a ritual bath. And this card is ruled by Aquarius, and the traditional rulership for Aquarius was Saturn, right? After
Right.
the star card, that's the 17th card in the major arcana, you have the moon card, right? This corresponds with the lunar age. And then you have the sun card. This corresponds with the solar age. What do you see in the sun card? You see a young boy or two young children. This is emblematic of this age, the solar age, actually being the youngest age, being the most modern sort of age. And also, this lines up very nicely with my understanding about Saturn having more of a feminine correspondence way back when, and that there was essentially, from what I gather, the best way I can put it, I think, is that there was a fall from grace for with Saturn symbolically and with the reverence of Saturn. So I think it went from a golden age feminine symbol to a dark age masculine symbol. And so we almost called our Lost Lore of Saturn series, those two videos, we almost called them from the dark mother to the dark father. I think that that's kind of been the large arc that we've seen over time.
Oh, that is so fascinating. Okay. There's a bunch of places I want to go with that. And I'll be curious kind of what your read is on the Golden Age, but what little research I've done, and I wish I had the citations handy, but they're not. I can send them to you later. If I
Sure.
find them, I'll post them in the show notes too. But when I was I did a whole program on Saturn last year, and when I was talking about Saturn as the ruler of the Golden Age, the Golden Age, from the description that I have, was when there was peace on Earth. There was harmony between humans and the Earth itself, and harmony between humans and nature, harmony among humans. And one of the people I heard about this from first talked about the fact that at that time there was what he called sincerity of soul. And so the way I kind of interpreted that is that the rules were on the inside, right? That the people were living in integrity, not integrity with some outside standard, but integrity with themselves and their souls. And that Saturn represented that sort of complete balance. And I'll say one more thing that I'd be curious about your take on is that the closest I've been able to see a historical reference for this, and the woman who wrote Chalice, The Chalice and the Blade, talks about it. It was the period of time on the island of Minos, I think it was called, the Minoan culture. And I don't know if you're familiar with the Minoan snake goddess, but it's a woman who's naked from the waist down, or who has her breasts exposed. I don't know if she's totally naked, but her breasts are exposed. And she's holding a snake in either hand. And to me, where I'm going with this is that that feels very much like Aquarian symbolism, right? The two snakes, which is the symbol for Aquarius, unless you consider that waves and water or electricity or something. And that to me, I have at least proposed that she might be the feminine face of Saturn. Now, I have no proof for that. I don't have any good reference material, but the symbolism feels very familiar. So I'm just curious what your sense is of that.
I mean, I can absolutely see that. I haven't really made public some of my serpentine correspondence information related to Saturn, but there's a lot going on there for sure. And it's interesting because I see Saturn, especially nowadays, there's arguably a lot of information related to Saturn that has to do with the sort of end of a space, right? The partition of a space, the walls of a place, right? The shell of an egg is kind of something I always bring up. And there's also this more primordial symbolism that relates it to the center of that space and the middle of that place, right? And the serpent relates to that as well. You'll find that there's a lot of serpentine symbolism that relates to the expanse of the universe or the cosmos. You can look into world serpent symbolism about that. A serpent that wraps itself around the whole entire universe or around Earth. But there's also a lot of symbolism about the serpent being in the middle, right? Wrapping up a pole, going up a tree, wrapping around a central stone, something along those lines. And so I'm really realizing that a lot of fundamental important symbols relate to the totality of everything, but then also the center of everything as well. So the stone is like a really good example of that. The stone, if you look into it, part of its primordial significance is that it represents the cosmos as a whole. So it represents kind of like this house of God sort of concept, but it also represents the middle of the house of God. It represents the middle of the cosmos or the middle of the universe. The Kaaba cube is basically the same thing. Temples are kind of the same thing as well. So the Kaaba cube on one hand represents the universe itself, the house of God, but then it also represents the middle of the universe as well, which is why it's a pilgrimage location for people who go to that center point and then go around it. And so I'm sorry, what was your original question here? And then I know you started talking about the Minoan goddess.
Yeah, no, I was kind of curious about that. Oh, your sense of Saturn connection, the connection to the Golden Age, and how you would define the Golden Age, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, no, what you mentioned tracks with what I understand about it as well. And I'll say that the reason why it was like this, from what I've read, and I have to give yet another shout out to an author that I'm really infatuated with right now. His name is René Guénon, and he is a master symbologist, I would say. And he understands a lot of this material very, very well, and he can relay it very nicely. And what he says essentially is that the big difference between this primordial golden age and what we're living in now is basically the concept of the center being understood back then, but then now being lost. So people are off center these days. People are ungrounded these days. People largely don't have a sort of point of focus. People don't have something to revolve their life around. In the primordial age, my understanding was that people had a sort of central point of their spiritual sort of foundation. There was something that brought everybody together. And you really see this with pilgrimage locations. And so, just like with the Kaaba Cube in Mecca, like I just brought up, that is a point of pivot, that is a point of focus. No matter where you're at in the world, if you're a Muslim, you pray in the direction of the Kaaba Cube. And, you know, they sell compasses that literally just have the direction of the Kaaba Cube there. So you have a place to channel, you know, your spiritual sort of work. And then you physically go there and then you go around it. So literally, it's a point of pivot, it's a center for you and your people. And so what René Guénon says is that it's the center that has been lost, that is the difference between a golden age and a dark age. And so if the golden age is ever going to return, it's going to be a recovery or a rediscovery of this sort of sacred center. And my understanding is that people back then would always have a central totem. And so they would have either a central tree, a standing stone, a stone, there would be a central mound, there might be a temple, something along these lines. And that this central totem is what they believed connected heaven and earth together. And that the central point symbolically represents the bridge or the axis between the above and the below, basically. And so that central point for them meant everything to them. And so that's what they believed in. That's what they sort of fought for. That's what they defended. And when this sort of central location is lost, I've heard that you basically see that the people also became lost. And so we don't have these sorts of ideas anymore. But this interfaces with the fixed star thing because the North Star, to find your North Star is to find your guiding star, which essentially is getting towards your center, right? And so that's what I tend to harp on with readings and a lot of the videos on my channel, especially presentations. I like to talk about this idea because as I'm learning about the sort of metaphysics and symbolism of the center, I'm getting closer to my center and I kind of feel like I'm finding myself, like my authentic self, my authentic path. And so, one sort of symbolic relationship with all of this is the wheel. And so, you can't really escape the wheel. You can't escape, you know, the wheel of heaven or the wheel of life, if you want to put it that way. You're not going to escape the circumference of the wheel, but the old school sort of mystical way of looking at it is that you can go to the center of the wheel, though. And so, you go to the still point in the middle. And there's a lot of names for this still point. Sometimes it's called the immutable center, the invariable middle, things of that sort. But you can become what has been said, the title has been referred to as the immovable mover or the unmoved mover, that you can be the mover of the wheel, but you are still in the middle. So going to the still point within, you know, gives you a whole new appreciation too about what you have immediately around you, the abundance of everything immediately around you. You know, we live in a world where everyone's exporting everything, basically. And so everything to them is outside of self. And so when you are basically looking for external validation, you know, external sort of, you know, information and everything else, you're going to receive a lot of other things that kind of come with that. There's a lot of baggage that comes with that. And so I think that people in this golden age, everything was coming more from this inner sort of place, which gave them a center and grounded them. And that's why people, I think, were able to get along. And that's why I think people were more holistic and things like that. And they were probably more so concerned with what's happening immediately around them. You know, they probably had their own central totems that they considered to be at the center of the earth. That's kind of the correspondence with all of these central sort of objects, the Kaaba cube and things like that. The Omphalos stone is another example. There's a lot of different examples all over the world of this, but one of the things you'll find is that this central object to them, to these people, they often consider this to be the center of the world. And in a way, they're symbolically all right, and that this is actually a very healthy thing for people to have this kind of reverence for something in their backyard, not something that's, you know, around the world or what have you.
Yeah, and what it makes me, I mean, it makes me think about a lot of things, but Saturn rules the skeleton and the skin. So there you have the center and the periphery, right? Just as you're talking about. And one of the things that I think is so relevant here is that, as you say, people have lost their center. And I think it's kind of comes back to this whole what I consider my work with Saturn to be helping people come back to my center, right? To coming back into integrity with myself, bringing back my frame of reference, my point of reference to my own center. And you've said it before too, is that we as humans fulfill some of the same purpose, if you will, as a tree, right? We connect heaven and earth. But we can only do that when we are what I call vertically aligned, right? And you could think of it as chakras, you can think of it as skeleton, and whatever you want to think about, it's that alignment between my top and my base, and that everything is in integrity, right, within. It's not integrity from out there. I think that's another misused word, but it's that integrity with myself. And it's interesting. There's when I was doing workshops about this time that we're in this about a 7 year time of transition. I went and did a little bit of research on human design just because something caught my attention. I don't know very much about it. I'm not a human design fan or practitioner, but the founder of the human design. It one of my favorite quotes, and he's talking about this 2027, what they call the Great Mutation, is you can't trust the authorities out there anymore, so stop. And it's it, it the theory, as I understand it from them, is that we're in this transition from everything being outwardly focused, right? My purpose is out there, fitting into a box of the culture, or I get approval from out there, or authority is out there, experts are out there, to a time. And I think this is a very Aquarian concept where my true north, my guiding principle, my center is in here. And that seems to jive with exactly what you're talking about. And in a way, it's almost like this is how we, as you'd say it, maybe return to the golden age or return to the next golden age, right? We're not going back, we're going forward.
That's it. That's it. Exactly. Yeah, that all makes sense to me. That's how I tend to perceive everything as well. And it's really interesting when you look into the symbolism. I'm just thinking of right now, the symbolism related to spinning or revolutions or cycles. When you go clockwise, that is more of an expansive and what has been referred to as a solar sort of dynamic. So I think it's very interesting that we all, you know, grew up probably with clocks in the classroom and things like that, right? There's 12 numbers. That's a very solar sort of number, right? And when you see the hands going clockwise, that's actually more expansive. And so that's what I think makes a lot of sense with living in this solar sort of paradigm right now, is what people are doing with externalized everything, experts and things like that, as you're saying. Now, when you go counterclockwise, this is known as being a polar rotation, meaning that it's more restricted. It actually goes towards the center. And so I think that's really the key here is that you want to go towards your center. People have said for a long time, know thyself and you'll know the universe. You know, a lot of meditative, visual works of art have that sacred center right there, the mandala, as an example, right? Everything is based around that center point. And as I mentioned, the wheel, right? Everything revolves around a central sort of point. And that center point relates to this axis, right? That bridges the gap between the above and the below. And so I can co-sign basically everything that you're saying because I think that that's really truly where it's at. And so Saturn plays a part, and historically, it seems as though was aligned with that central point. But nowadays, we only focus on, you know, the external sort of circumference of the wheel or what's happening outside of self and things of that sort. But yeah, absolutely. I'm really passionate about this topic because I've seen a difference within myself. You know, it's kind of been said that if you're thinking too far ahead, you're going to be prone to anxiety. If you're thinking too far in the past or you're prone to thinking about the past, you might be prone to depression. But being in the present moment, you're going to be prone to peace. And that still point in the middle of the wheel, kind of what we're referring to here, that is indicative of presence and stillness. So once again, the pole star, all of the other stars have their own sort of cycle, but the pole star is the only star that's going to be there night after night, the exact same spot, and never move. At least from our perspective on Earth, and at least from our, you know, lifetime. In our lifetime, it'll be in the same place.
Yes, and everything that you just said, like a big yes. I mean, I think, yeah, like it, that, you know, Saturn's been life changing for me too. It's like I really got just like light bulbs coming on in the last couple of years. I'm curious, like, what else would you say about, well, even on a practical level, how have you found yourself not just seeing Saturn, but working with Saturn to come towards this sense of being centered in yourself? Have you got like specific things you learned or specific things you do or?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, as an example, this is really it's a small thing, but I think it's fascinating and there's a huge symbolic overlap with this, but I have a compass on my altar as an example. And so I have a compass on my altar, and where do all compasses point? They point north, right? And so to me, what I've learned on an esoteric level, if you want to put it that way, is that the North symbolically has corresponded with this center sort of idea, you know? And if you look at a compass on a 2D plane, if you just, you know, are looking at a picture of it or you're looking at it from the top down, you can say that there is actually a correspondence, and there is more to it than this, but North points upward, right? So there's actually a relationship between this vertical axis that you brought up, which is exactly completely spot on. And this is a lot of what I've been reading about lately as well. But there's kind of this relationship with this vertical axis being related to up. And so when you look at a compass, the up direction, the up point corresponds with the north. And so I think it's fascinating that a lot of ancient peoples had this sort of relationship with the north being the center. And so if you look at Earth from a top-down perspective, the north is going to be dead center, right? And so this compass to me is a reminder to continue pursuing my true north, right? Which is basically another way of saying continue to go towards your center, right? And so continue to be in the moment, you know, stop and smell the roses. Don't be so completely fixated on everything that's going on in the future. Don't be completely fixated on things maybe that could be perceived as being regrettable in the past, but be here right now. And I think this is all very interesting because the winter solstice, historically, there's been variations on this theme, but my understanding is that largely the winter solstice, which corresponds with the beginning of Capricorn, right, that this has actually been related to as the direction that corresponds with North. And so the winter solstice has a northern correspondence to it. Where does Santa come from? He comes from the North Pole, right? And so there is this inherent, deep, embedded relationship with Capricorn, with Saturn, with this northern sort of idea. And so I try and keep that in mind personally. And I personally think that a lot of this information can fall in line with what I refer to as polar wisdom. And that is to say, things that go back to your center, your pole. I often tell people that if someone has lost their way, what I tend to say to like my fiance Michelle, I say that they've given away their pole, essentially. And so you need to reclaim your pole. You need to reclaim your center, right? You need to bring things within. You don't need to completely externalize, your life and seek external validation. And so what I like to say too is that I think that, it's probably for the best, and this is how I live my life, but I'm not looking for an external messiah, and I'm also not looking for an external scapegoat either. And so I think it's interesting that this scapegoating concept relates to the goat and relates to Capricorn and Saturn and things like that. And so I'm not looking for excuses. I want to be responsible for my own actions, and I want to own my actions, and I want to sort of basically what I've tried to do is really hold up all of my sort of stuff, all of my decisions in life, and I'm trying to put it on a pedestal instead of trying to sweep it under the rug. I'm trying to integrate all of my bad decisions and all of my traumas and all of my heartaches and all that kind of stuff. Instead of ignoring it and not addressing it, I'm actually transmuting it, and I'm looking at it in terms of, well, this is what has got me to where I am at right now, and I'm actually grateful, and that there's lessons with all of this. And Saturn is all about lessons, and so Saturn is the ultimate sort of disciplinarian in a lot of ways, maybe more so in the way people look at it today. But you basically you can look towards Saturn as being also your inner disciplinarian, right? And so you kind of being that person instead of waiting for someone else to kind of tell you what to do in life or whatever. It's like you need to hold yourself accountable. But I have my own sort of, I guess, practice or little rituals or what have you, or I try and acknowledge the center for what it is. I try and kind of incorporate some of my polar understanding of things. And now with what I know, Saturn is just like right there and like completely interfaces with a lot of this stuff. So it really just all syncs up very nicely.
I agree with that. And I, listening to you talk about, discipline is one of those, well, one of the things I've done in my Saturn work is sort of unpack some of the words associated with discipline, with Saturn. Like discipline comes from the word disciple, right? So to have self discipline means to be a disciple of yourself.
There you go.
And then commitment, I think commitment, duty, responsibility, discipline, all those words, at least when I say them, and maybe it's because I grew up in the military, right? All those words have such a heavy, rigid sort of sense to them, but I think it's what the distortion that we've created around all things Saturnian in our modern time. Because when you start to unpack those words, like discipline comes from disciple, responsibility means the ability to respond. Commitment actually means with a mission, right? That's kind of the roots of the words are with and mission. And I'm curious, just thinking about this, the ways that we've distorted it, what do you have a like a sense of where that distortion came from? And maybe this leads you into a little bit about the solar age. I don't know.
Yeah, no, yeah, you're exactly right. So it's really interesting. When it comes to all of this stuff, I definitely have my hunches with things, and I've been used to being wrong in my past with research and everything. So I'm open more than ever to kind of acknowledging that there are more wrinkles that I have yet to understand and everything else. But it really seems like, there was this great transition, as I've been explaining, between these three different ages. Now, the lunar age, I almost kind of consider to be this intermediary sort of age, almost a very transitional age, which is very interesting considering lunar symbolism and everything that the moon generally is related to. And but what I've been really tracking, right, is this polar to solar sort of shift. So there was a book that I read. If people want to dive deep into this material, there's an author named John O'Neill. He wrote a couple of books called The Night of the Gods, and he talks about this. In fact, this was the first time I had ever read this before. And this book, I think, came out in the 1880s or the 1890s. And he talks about polar versus solar worship. And little fireworks went off, right, in my mind. I'm like, whoa, polar versus solar worship. I've never even heard about this before. And he gets into it and he explains that there were deities that were known as being polar deities, that they were related to the center. They were related to this bridge between heaven and earth, this central sort of place. And that a lot of these deities transitioned over time to being solar deities. And so even literally the category of polar deity, people don't have an understanding of that. I would say the most popular understanding of it actually literally is Santa coming from the North Pole and corresponding, I would say, in large part with Saturn and Capricorn and things like that. But the example he really got into was this Egyptian god, Ptah. And so Ptah has a shaved head. He stands very upright. He's holding a staff right in front of him, the pole. And actually, this is where we get the Oscar statue from. The Oscar statue is essentially mirroring Ptah, basically. And he was saying that way back when Ptah was a polar deity, over time he became a solar deity. And so I think a lot of the distortion with this has to do with heliocentrism, with the solarized age, with the introduction of the sun now being the main focus, now being sort of the focal point. And so to me, this explains the whole transition from a lot of signs, constellations, deities being feminine way back when to being now more masculine. Because we're in Taurus season, I feel like Taurus is actually a really good sort of example of this. And I think I brought it up in that presentation, the Lost Lore conversation, that when I think of Taurus now, I see more of the feminine, and I understand that there's a huge feminine correspondence. You're dealing with the middle sign of spring. You're dealing with a sign that is ruled by Venus, versus back in the day, I saw it more so as a masculine thing. I would think of the angry bull, the muscular, strong sort of bull, that presence. But when you look into it, that doesn't really track with how people used to view bull symbolism or cow symbolism, rather. It was me going to India that I really see the other side of it, this reference for the sacred cow and the sacred cow being referred to as like the second mother of mankind. And it gives so much, right? And then how Hindus generally depict the cow, it is more feminine, it is more motherly. So when we think of Taurus, it's actually the feminine cow, not the masculine bull. And I'm also inclined to think too that Capricorn being the goat, it was actually more of a she-goat back in the day versus a old sort of masculine kind of goat figure, right? And so it was more about, the dark feminine or the crone, and now it's kind of the old man. So from the crone to Chronos, I think that's really interesting. Chronos having crone right there in it. I think that there's some sort of relationship there that's probably worth digging into a little bit. So I see with the sun becoming more prominent in every aspect of life, I think, and especially symbolically being the symbolic sort of center for modern man. I think that that's when a lot of the distortion came into place. I think that's when a lot of things became more masculine, and that's when the feminine got swept under the rug. And I think that this also corresponds with this kind of off-center sort of business because the sun kind of demands your attention, and for good reason too. It's so brilliant. It's the most brilliant, luminary in the sky. Woman and symbolism associated with the woman tends to be more passive. And so there's a lot of myths where like the solar deity is this big, bright, expansive, projective sort of thing, wants the attention, wants the glory. But I think that the arrogance with a lot of these myths with that figure is that he thinks that he's the supreme deity. He thinks that he is, the end all be all sort of God. What he doesn't realize, like in the Gnostic creation story, is that he has a mother, that he came from somewhere, you know? And so that's what you see in the Gnostic creation story. The Demiurge doesn't realize that he has a mom, Sophia, but yet he is so powerful that he can kind of trick himself even, or convince himself that he is the main deity, the end all be all that has ever been. But this is just part of his blindness, part of his arrogance.
Yeah, oh, I love that. And you know, it's the whole masculine feminine, of course we could probably spend another hour on, but one of the things that struck me when I read that book, The Chalice and the Blade by Breanne Isler, is that she's talking about kind of the shift from the chalice, the feminine, to to the blade as being, you know, the power, just as you're talking about this, the shift to the solar age. But then what she says, and again, it goes back to the island of Crete and the Minoan culture, is that there was a time which we can't conceptualize anymore because of the like our conditioning, but there was a time where things were in balance, and it was the masculine didn't have superiority and power over the feminine, but the feminine didn't have superiority and power over the masculine. And that, and it seems very similar to what you're saying, is that, you know, we've gotten, because we're so off center, we think that one side, right, has to be stronger than the other, and that there's one that's always in control or in power, because we can't even remember when we were fully centered and things were literally in balance. And of course, you know, Saturn, this is Saturn is exalted in the sign of Libra, which is the sign of the scales, which has that fulcrum point, where we're centered.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting. I did two shows called The Axis of Libra, and I got into that fulcrum point. I got into that vertical axis of the scales and how it actually relates to this world axis, northern kind of concept that I've been harping on about here. And that's interesting too, this balancing point. You know, that's why for me, I tend to personally, if I had a planetary sort of reverence that is higher than anything else, for me personally, it would probably be Mercury. And that Mercury, you know, is it speaks to me on so many different levels, as do all of them, all of the planets, you know. But Mercury being this the culmination of the masculine and the feminine, this sort of divine androgyne sort of thing, you know, kind of being more so the middle path, or the middle way is how I tend to perceive it. But one of the things that I've learned is that Saturn seems to have a mercurial sort of aspect related to it too, with exactly what you're saying, you know, this balancing sort of dynamic, right? And so I tend to see Mercury everywhere. I see it with so many different signs too, and so many different myths, where I'm like, what isn't Mercury? You know, so it's one of these planets that I'm still continuing to unpack and learn from and everything else. But yeah, you know, the center of the wheel is the most balanced place in the wheel as well, you know. And so when you look into wheel symbolism, it's said that the center, the middle, is where the reconciliation of opposites occurs, where things are actually truly unified. You know, the circumference of the wheel, this relates to multiplicity, this relates to a lot of things kind of being divided. You can almost look at the spokes of a wheel, right? You have all these different wedges, right? But it's the center point of the wheel where everything really comes together. And in that way, kind of symbolically represents like the monad, or the one, if you want to put it that way. But yeah, fascinating stuff. I love all the things you're bringing to the table too, by the way. And the discipline thing with disciples, I had read that at one point, but it's definitely worth kind of chewing on again, because a lot of these words have been completely distorted, but the meaning behind it, when you really dig into it, there's just another layer of information that kind of comes out that's really valuable.
Again, my brain just went in about five different directions
I believe it.
too. What else? There was something else I want to ask you, but it just kind of went out of my mind right now. What else?
Yeah, no worries.
What else is on your mind about Saturn and the symbolism and the poles and
Yeah.
solar versus?
Yeah. One of the things that I wanted to mention too is just it's so fascinating to me. What I've learned over the years is that there really are different tiers of gods. And so you could say like a new celebrity, someone that gets really popular right now, especially in the, age that we live in with TikTok and social media and things like that. You can become famous overnight, literally, and your life can change forever. And so there seems to be a quickening sort of thing, right? Especially as you get older too, it feels like things just move faster anyway. But that would be an overnight deity. That would be like an overnight god, as an example, symbolically. Someone who really reaches kind of fame and stardom and everything else in this day and age. That's like an overnight sort of god being initiated into this sort of new kind of thing. But there are gods that have existed, for a very, 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 very long time that will continue to exist for a very long time. And there are just different tiers of deity. And so that's what I've learned is that the solar deity in many ways is a younger god, and so that's why on the sun card you have this young child, either on a horse or two young children in front of a wall. I think he's a younger deity. And so what I've learned and tracked over time, and some of this gets very, very esoteric, but the oldest deities correspond to the north, which is really fascinating to think about. And so a lot of the oldest gods come from the northern sky. And so I've read this a number of times at this point from different authors. So to me, I feel like there definitely is something there. And the goat has essentially been used as kind of the animal totem for some of these oldest gods, basically. And so I'm thinking of like Pan as an example, or some of these other goat gods, where basically they represent an older period of time. They represent a more primordial time. They represent a pagan era, basically. And so when you look into the mythology of Pan, Pan died when Christianity came into play. And so there's this whole thing about the great god Pan is dead, and all of the animals in the forest mourned. They say that when he died, it was announced, and you could hear the animals of the forest weep, basically. And so to me, this is a symbolic representation of this age shift, from a primordial time, which has more of a polar northern sort of aspect to it, to a Christianized sort of newer time, which is more of a solar thing. So again, a polar to solar sort of shift. And so that's what I wanted to mention is that the goat seems to me to have always interfaced with this older classification of God from an earlier time, basically. And so that's another thing that, right along the lines with Saturn has been scapegoated, right? The goat itself, wild and rambunctious and lusty and all of these different types of things. And so where does that come from? I think it came from this sort of shift, right? But when you look into goat symbolism, it's the way I tend to perceive it is a lot of this heavy energy. Saturn is obviously, related to lead and the color black and things like that. There's a whole conversation to be had about ascension, right? What does ascension really mean? I really see it as just getting closer to your center. Which corresponds with that vertical that you brought up, that vertical axis. And so, but what was I going to say? So, I see it that if there is any kind of ascension, or if there is sort of this migration to the center, that it happens in steps. And so I did a presentation called Seven Gates to the Great Beyond. I talk about the number seven. I talk about Libra and its relationship with going to the underworld, the dark side of the zodiac, the night side of the zodiac. And I talk about this seven-tiered nature to get to your center. And then also what kind of like a lot of ancient cultures have said, seven steps to get to the underworld or to get to, the other side, basically. And this has a relationship with the traditional seven planets, right? But the fact of the matter is, everything is always step by step based. And so you can't go up the steps. You can't climb a mountain without first taking that initial step, right? And so that is to say that it's like, how can you get to your lightest self? How can you reach your full potential without taming the lowest aspect of self? Without taming sort of the inner beast or symbolically, you know, the kind of the demons within or whatever. And so that's what I think about when I think about the devil card, which corresponds with Capricorn and is ruled by Saturn, is that it's like it's this first step that everyone has to take. So it's fundamental, you know. So you're not going to reach these higher steps without first addressing all of this other stuff down below. And so I think that that is one of the things that a lot of people don't understand too, in a way. With some Saturnian symbolism, kind of the heavier sort of aspects, or even like our lower chakras or whatever. It's like you're not gonna, you know, climb that mountain. You're not going to, basically integrate, you know, what these chakras are all about until you take those first initial steps up that sort of pole or up that ladder.
Yeah, and it actually, as you're speaking about that, I don't, it reminds me of the journey of Inanna, right? In that particular myth, where it's seven steps down into the underworld, where she's killed and hung on a meat hook, and then seven steps to come back up and out. So it's like you've got to go down to come back up, right? And she goes down as the queen of heaven, but she comes back up as the queen of heaven and earth. And
Yes, exactly.
her sister is the underworld goddess in this case, and I've always equated her with Pluto, but in many ways she could be equated with Saturn, you know, because before we had Pluto, before we added the la the those three planets and more to the pantheon, Saturn had a lot of those characteristics of Pluto. And so you could think of that underworld journey as coming to meet self, right? Saturn. And coming to the center, and that you can't, as you say, transcend until you get through. You've got to go through, and it's the death and rebirth. And that is a lot of what Saturn was about.
Yes, yeah, exactly right. For sure. You know, I even think too, one of the notes that I have written down here is just literally the word Saturn, right? And I even think of there's so much going on there actually. It's very simple, but there's a lot happening. But one of the first things that I felt like I really wanted to unpack for myself was urn and how urn is right there, you know, and you think about an urn and what it's used for, but then it's also a vessel. And then I think about Aquarius and then the vessel of Aquarius. And just as you mentioned earlier too, which I love, you know, the fact that Aquarius and what's in the urn, what's in the vessel, it could be electricity, it's pure spirit, it's ether, you know, it's potential, you know, it's light. I've heard that as well, that it's pure light that's in the urn of Aquarius, right? And so and then thinking about Saturn relating to this partition sort of idea or this wall, again the shell of an egg and the egg being a container, and then what's within the container, right? It's all potential, it's all possibility, you know, all of these types of things. So I think that's fascinating to think about Saturn relating to all vessels, right? All containers, right? It keeps things within, it keeps things together basically, right? Related to that sort of constrictive sort of nature of it. And so without that, where would we be? You know,
Right.
we need that. That's essential. That's necessary.
Right. Yeah, I always think about it, you know, from a very kind of weirdly esoteric point of view. If you think about the soul's journey to incarnation on the planet, on the Earth, the first real planet it comes through is Saturn. And I always think of that as the funnel, right? The necking down of the infinity of the cosmos. And so I associate it with embodiment because it does rule 3D reality, you know, and it's like you can't get in without coming through Saturn, and then you can't get out without going through Saturn again either.
That's right. Yeah, exactly right. 100%. Yeah, you know, this relates to so many different things. I know we could talk forever about it, but one of the other things I want to mention too is this idea of evolution versus involution, which I'm not sure if you've ever looked into, but to me, So evolution is more of an expansive sort of concept, right? So if you look into evolution, everyone's going to mention the Big Bang theory and everything else. I perhaps wonder if this is actually an inversion of how things potentially happen, that before expansion can happen, there was a great contraction. And so we actually live within what could be said as something of a black hole, right? That actually the universe itself didn't evolve outward, it went into itself. And that's actually this big container. And so, literally, it's the principle of Saturn that actually got everything going. And it's interesting, at least what I've read before, is that the heart itself, that it's the restrictive nature of the heart that allows the whole entire system to go with the pumping of blood and everything. And so, literally, this restrictive sort of nature, I don't know if it makes sense to debate what came first, contraction or expansion, because of, it's a chicken and egg sort of situation. But restriction and contraction has its place here, and it's more fundamental than what people realize. I think a lot of modern people in the solarized world, it's just the focus is always on this expansive sort of nature, this outer sort of thing. But this inner dynamic, it plays a part in literally everything here. And so, so people like to say that, oh, I've evolved as a person, and I'm not saying that you shouldn't use that word, but I'm kind of interested in involution now, not necessarily evolution, right? Involution is more of the feminine internal sort of dynamic of getting closer to that pole and things kind of going towards that middle. And going towards that middle too seems to be, it's almost like this illusory sort of thing. It's like an infinite sort of journey. Do you actually ever reach that center? I don't know. It doesn't seem like necessarily you do, because as soon as you reach it, you kind of come back out of it anyway. And so it's kind of like this Taurus field sort of dynamic where things return to the center, but as soon as that happens, they expand from the center. But I just want to bring up that restrictive sort of nature and involution, going within. It's like I could see it that this universe basically was involved, that maybe there was space, but the space went into itself, and this void or this vacuum actually created, space for everything to kind of exist potentially.
I'm not up on it well enough, but I bet you that if you went and did a little bit of a search on kind of what scientists are saying right now about black holes and the universe, I bet that concept is in there.
I bet you're right.
I what you said about expansion contraction, I completely agree with that. We're so focused on expansion that we forget that contraction is part of the natural cycle. But I think kind of we're just so out of touch with the natural cycles in general, and we forget that things aren't static and they don't go in just one direction.
That's right. And it's interesting to me, thinking about the winter and the winter solstice and Capricorn and all of that. It's when nature is receding. It's when nature is receding. It's literally when leaves are falling off of trees and things are more dormant and cold. It's when hibernation happens for certain animals and things like that. So it's when people go inside more, which is going to bring you inside more, And so it's just that time. But one of the beautiful sorts of things that I've learned is that this is actually when roots go deeper. This is when the root system actually goes deeper and further into the earth, making it a more strong plant, more strong tree. And so it just corresponds with all of this stuff beautifully as well.
Well, that I like you say, I know we could talk for another hour because it makes me want to talk about the duality and the masculine feminine and some of the other distortions, but this feels like a good place to kind of leave it now. What do you think?
Perfect, perfect. Sounds good with me. This was awesome.
Yeah, I know this is great. I so appreciate you joining me, Mario, because I it, it's I love there's a part of me that loves the esoteric piece because it does inform the practical, right? And you've talked about that from your life. The esoteric and the symbolism has informed even your marriage, your relationship with Michelle. When are you planning to get married? Do you have a date?
We do. It's September 14th.
Oh, cool. Okay.
And so I proposed during Virgo season last year, and then we just decided to wait a whole year. And then For my money, I know this might be a really simplistic way of looking at it, but there's a lot of bridal symbolism that corresponds with Virgo. And so I thought that kind of worked out nicely that way.
Yeah, I love that. And to me, Virgo is like the priest or the priestess that unites the sacred and the mundane. And that's what, in a lot of ways, that's what you're doing, right? With marriage.
Absolutely. Yeah,
Yeah.
100%.
Oh, that's so cool. Well, thank you again. And for those listening, the link will be in the show notes, but it's symbolicstudies.com, right? Is that correct?
That's it, yeah.
And then you're also on Instagram under Symbolic Studies.
Yeah, so they can find all my links on my site because there are some variations with how it's spelled just because the accounts were taken. But if they go to symbolicstudies.com, they can find everything there.
Okay. And you have a Patreon site as well. Do you still have that?
I do. I do. That is patreon.com/symbolicstudies. And up until this point, it's basically been a sort of general support page. But I'm actually starting a new series that's going to be exclusive to patrons and supporters. And that's going to be a Major Arcana series. So what I'm going to be doing is going through the Major Arcana one card at a time. And this was inspired because a student reached out, wanted to learn more about the tarot. And I was surprised that he even suggested it, but he said, let's spend one session per card. And so we spent 22 weeks going over each card. And I wrote a ton of notes for every single card, did my research and reviewed, what I had around with each card. And then when we were done with the Major Arcana, he said, can we do the rest of the tarot? I'm like, if you want to, that's a lot of cards. And so we didn't do one card per week, but I think we did two cards per week. But anyway, I was with that student for months talking tarot, and I walked away with a lot. I walked away with a new appreciation for a lot of cards, a lot of new nuggets I hadn't really considered beforehand. And so I'm like, this would actually be a really good Patreon exclusive, is just to put together one presentation, really dive deep on every card too. There's a lot of resources out there where you can find the basic information. And so this isn't a 101 sort of thing. This is for people who want to learn, like, some of the more esoteric sort of aspects of each card and the deep, deep symbolism with each card. So that'll be launching here within the next couple of weeks.
That's exciting. Yeah, that's really exciting. Well, and having had a tarot reading with you, I love the way that we really got to go into the nuances and the depth of it. That
Excellent.
I appreciate that. I like to work that way with getting below the surface level that you can find pretty much anywhere.
Right, exactly.
Cool. Oh, that's great. Okay. Well, thank you again for being here today. I can see that if we wanted to do this again, we'd have lots of stuff to talk about.
Absolutely, anytime.
Yeah. And thank you all for listening to the Natural Wisdom Podcast. And the only other announcement I have is that if you missed my workshop on empowered astrology and how to kind of unlock some of the distortions, I'll put the link in the notes again, and it's still available by recording. And Mario, I'm just going to stop the recording and we can chat for a minute, but thank you again for being part of the podcast.
You got it.